Okay, colleagues, I'm going to call to order this, let's see, what are we? April, oh yeah, tax day, April 15, 2013. Meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Welcome, members of the audience. We have, not surprisingly, a very full agenda today. Let me tell you, first of all, so we're going to start off with the public hearing on House Bill 3115, and I'll bring Rep. Polvey up. But let me tell you, House Bill 2986 is not yet ready to go. I think the issues around that, that's the one about the driver's license for people in the pre-apprenticeship programs. Yeah. The agencies are still working out the process for that. It should be ready this morning. Most of the others will at least be able to adopt amendments for and get things set up for Wednesday. And I think about half of them will actually be able to vote on. So I want to open up a public hearing then on House Bill 3115. Victoria, would you tell us what this is about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3115 prohibits public agencies from entering into public works contracts of $750,000 or more without verifying every employer under contract is an approved apprenticeship training agent unless no local, joint, committee, or apprenticeship training program exists. Requires contractors and subcontractors to employ apprentices for specified minimum number of hours worked on project by workers in apprenticeable occupations, subject to adjustment by BOLI. Requires BOLI to develop, adopt, and revise plan to increase diversity among workers employed on public projects, including apprentices. Directs advisory committee to evaluate apprenticeship percentage requirements and assist BOLI in administration of related prevailing wage requirements. Requires certified statement from every contractor on public project concerning employment of apprentices on public works projects. Creates a civil penalty of $20 times the number of hours required but not worked by apprentices. Establishes the State Apprenticeship Training and Education Fund and directs the state treasurer to deposit penalties collected into the fund for distribution to State Apprenticeship Training Council for specified purposes.
Thank you, Victoria. That was a mouthful. Rep. Polvey, welcome. Welcome to the Workforce Committee, and tell us, please, what this bill's about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the records, Paul Holby, State Representative, District 8. Committee, this is a bill about apprenticeship utilization on public projects, essentially, but only those projects that have state funds in them. This is sort of the second piece to an effort to try to put apprentices to work and to try to replace the aging workforce that we have in the construction industry. I don't think anybody would argue that we are facing a huge workforce shortage in the future in the construction industry. The average age of construction workers is almost between 46 and 50, depending on what craft you're in. We haven't done a very good job, as you know, with funding career technical education in the state for the last 20 years. But I'm encouraged that we have started moving that direction with the CTE programs, and previously we have had a little bill come out of this committee that does direct some funds into pre-apprenticeship programs and partnerships with high schools. So about 10 years or a little less than 10 years before I got in the legislature, I was a chairman of a joint apprenticeship training committee, which is a committee made up of management and labor that oversees apprentices for a specific trade. My trade happened to be carpenters. And our job as an apprenticeship committee was essentially to oversee the program, review the standards, and to help the apprentices and follow them as far as making sure they met their benchmarks in education, and of course on the job hours. One of the huge problems that we would always face, especially when the economy got slow, was that apprentices would get laid off. And so you would have, and usually these are four-year programs, you could have 1 year to 3 years invested in training an apprentice, and all of a sudden they can't get their on-the-job hours. And all that investment in the training then is at risk of disappearing because those apprentices go, well, I got to make a living. I'm going to go do something else. And so it's it became a real issue. And so the point of this bill really is to provide on-the-job training dedicated hours on some public projects that require state funds. It currently is the policy in our ORS 279, which is the public contracting for construction code of 279C, is to encourage apprenticeship and training to the skill standards. And you have to wonder, within usually a low bid world, how are we actually encouraging apprenticeship hours on those projects? And so utilization and having a certain percentage of hours being required to be performed by apprentices is the way this bill gets there. And it starts out with a pretty modest 10%. And I will refer to the Dash 1 amendments here fairly soon. But 10% under the Dash 1 amendment, and soon in your hands, maybe before this committee actually adjourns, you could have the Dash 2s. They set the threshold at $5 million for those projects that have state funds. So if it has $5 million or more, then the project would be subject to the apprenticeship requirements. The apprenticeship requirements under this proposal in the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 would be for the subcontracts and contracts for performing the work that are above $500,000. And so that is essentially it in a nutshell. In 2017, the project threshold would come down to $3 million, and the subcontract and contract for performing work would come down to $300,000. And the apprenticeship utilization rate would go up to 15%, trying to incrementally increase the amount of apprentices on jobs. Currently, most trades that are registered with apprenticeship programs do have mostly in their standards above 15%. So this isn't going to be a huge burden on apprenticeship programs, but really wanted to have some flexibility for contractors on some of these projects. The amendment also takes out the penalty provision that's in this bill completely. So there is no violation or penalty for non-performance. But what the bill does do is say at the front end that they're going to retain 3% of the subcontract or contract amount, not the total project amount, but just for the subcontract for each contractor, because each contractor has to meet this goal independently. So that penalty provision comes out. So what happens instead is to provide that incentive or disincentive, if you will, is that they retain 3% of that subcontract amount, and at the end of the job, for they can get that 3% paid out to them with the rest of their payments if they actually did reach that 10% goal. If for each hour that they're short of that 10% goal, they will have $20 that will be continued to be retained and up to 3% of that subcontract. And that retained amount will go into the State Apprenticeship Training and Education Fund in this bill, which you might remember was also in House Bill 2727, to provide some dollars for vocational ed programs as described for those high school partnerships and pre-apprenticeship programs. I will note that ODOT already has, and they use gas monies, as you know, that are somewhat restrictive, but they also use federal funds. And the Department of Transportation already has an apprenticeship utilization program. So they've been exempted from this bill, but only to the point where they need to substantially meet those apprenticeship goals. Because they already have a program that's meeting above 10% right now. So I didn't want to mess with a program they already have established, but it's pretty specific to ODOT. And so I will say that. There's also an exemption for minority small business, women-owned emerging businesses that have been in business less than 5 years to try to give them opportunities to get into the construction industry and public contracting and to get into apprenticeship programs. And so there's those are the nuts and bolts of this bill. I will say that under the new amendment that I hopefully you will have this morning, Section 6 of the Dash 1 amendment is going to be entirely deleted, which is a whole section about a new form that has to be prepared and turned in to BOLI and with penalties and progress payment retention. And there was a misunderstanding when I was describing this to Legislative Council. There is already a certified payroll statement that's required on public projects, and so all the new bill will do is basically document those apprentices and apprentice hours on those existing certified payroll statements, so you can keep track of the percentages. That's the proposal that's almost before you, and I appreciate your consideration. I think that this bill's pretty well thought out. Had a lot of discussions with a lot of different people. I know people are always nervous to put in requirements on public projects, but you know I've been working on this concept since 2005, and the more time that goes by, the more and more I guess dire our situation is with the workforce in the construction industry. So I urge you to support this and move this bill with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rep. Pulvey, and thank you for your long-standing commitment to this issue. Colleagues, any questions for Rep. Pulvey at this time? Rep. Johnson, and let me just back up. Obviously, we're not going to be able to vote on this bill today. This will be for Wednesday. Hopefully, we'll have the next set of amendments ASAP, so you'll have time to study them. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Colby, you mentioned that the penalties had been removed in the Dash 2s. Is that correct?
And in the Dash 1s.
Not exactly. Clarify what I was speaking to, that you didn't talk about then a 3% retainage is held aside, and then if the contractor doesn't perform as expected, he still has a $20 per hour penalty that goes into the fund. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would call it a retainage for not meeting the goal, not a penalty. The original bill actually has a penalty and a violation. It considers it a BOLI violation. And so that really didn't work out. And so there's retainage in contracts for all sorts of things. And so this is just incentive or disincentive to make sure you meet those goals. Or a disincentive if you don't.
Semantical differences, I guess.
Well, I think there's a big difference between an actual violation of law and a penalty and a retainage amount for goals.
So what about non-union shops? What about folks that don't have apprenticeship programs that you're referring to, but yet they're on the job and so forth? What does this do for them?
Well, I think in today's world, non-union contractors that do public projects have apprenticeship programs today, and have the ability to get into several programs. I know the AGC has programs, several non-union contractors. So, 20 years ago, you wouldn't see very many non-union apprenticeship programs. The times have changed. And especially on these public type of projects, you'll see non-union shops have the ability to have apprenticeship programs just the same as union.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Rep.
Thank you, Evan.
Okay, I'm going to call up John Rakowitz, Dave Katz, and John Mullis, please.
Good
the Rakowitz.
Good morning, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. John Rakowitz with the Associated General Contractors. Apprenticeship is, people on the labor side of our industry point out regularly, been around over 100 years. We expect it to be around the next 100, and we need it. It's a critical component of growing our future workforce. There are no questions about that. What I'm hoping the committee will consider today is how we get there, exactly how we do that. And we didn't have an apprenticeship bill on our agenda at the beginning of this session, but they started coming forward. So we thought the industry needed to take a hard look at this. And our best effort is contained in Senate Bill 782. It'll be in a work session this afternoon on the Senate side. And the principles that we tried to used to guide the shape of that is that it's got to work for industry in three different ways. It's got to work on all types of non-highway public construction projects, and there's a wide range of those. You can imagine a sewer system, you can imagine a specialty kind of job like an airport, a runway, any and everything in between. All types of contractors, unions, union shops, open shops, specialty contractors, and general contractors. We represent all of those. And in all parts of the state, sounds easy, a little more difficult when you get outside the I-5 corridor, just not the same availability of apprentices. So what would 782 do, Senate Bill 782? As originally introduced, it would, on state agency projects only of $5 million or larger, it would set a goal of 10% of the total work hours to be performed by apprentices, and establish $20 reimbursement rate for the apprenticeship hours worked on those jobs. And since we've introduced that bill, we've had any number of extensive conversations with impacted partners, be it on the labor side, be it public owners, in particular ODOT. So we have some Dash 3 amendments that will be up this afternoon on the Senate side, and they do three things. It changes the 10% goal to a requirement. It increases that requirement in January 2018, to 12%, and then it exempts ODOT from the policy. Why exempt ODOT? Well, ODOT has the only established program at the statewide level that's actually producing regular, consistent results. And I do have to note, though, that program was years in the making. I was personally involved in a long effort. It had a bit of a rough start, and then it turned into something very successful. But for one type of construction, bridge and highway, and for only one public owner. And so I have to underscore that it's a program. It's not a statewide apprenticeship standard, what we're discussing here today. And that's a big difference. What are the differences between the bill that I'm promoting, obviously, Senate Bill 782, and the bill in front of you today, HB 3115? Both bills represent a major policy shift. There's no doubt about that. By structuring and establishing for the first time in Oregon's history a statewide public works apprenticeship utilization standard. It's a mouthful, but that's what we're talking about here. It is a standard, and a certain amount of apprenticeship would have to be required. But they approach this in really different ways. We believe Senate Bill 782 is a more simple, direct, in a phased-in approach. House Bill 3115, I saw the Dash 1 amendments on Friday, so I'm certainly no expert on Dash 1s, but and haven't seen the Dash 2s. But everything I've been able to tell, it's more aggressive and it's a more complicated approach. I just want to call out a few of the things that jump out at us. And again, not an expert, but just first blush. First of all, HB 3115 establishes a requirement of at least 10% apprenticeable hours. And that means it establishes a floor with no ceiling. That's a big difference. And 782, it's a flat 10% requirement. Secondly, 3115 requires at least 15% in 2017. SB 782 increases the requirement to a flat 12% in 2018. So there's big difference there in the number of hours to be worked. House Bill 3115 applies to a broader group of agencies. It touches all projects. It's applied to all projects that touch state money. I assume that means OUS. It would appear that it does from the amendments I looked at, as well as community colleges and others. Senate Bill 782 applies only to DAS projects, period, minus ODOT. And this notion of retainage has us really confused. I don't know if this committee or members of this committee have seen the kind of issues and fights we've had over retainage. We've actually passed a bill in the Senate, 26-4, coming this way, to flatten for all parties in the chain of commerce 5%. No exemptions. This would add a whole other level and layer of complexity. So you would hold retainage specifically for apprenticeship hours. We're not sure how that would work, and we have real concerns about that. And it applies these standards to each contractor, general and specialty contractor, unlike our bill, which would simply do it for the job, and the general contractor is then responsible to do that and has the flexibility to do that in whatever manner makes sense on that particular job. So I hope I've been able to point out and distinguish how the two approaches are really quite different. If the legislature determines that it needs to take this step, the only bill we can support is Senate Bill 782. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Mr. Rakowitz. Why don't we hold off and hear from all three? Mr. Katz?
Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, my name is Dave Coots, and I'm Vice President of Finance for Paragon Tile and Stone and Tigard, and I live in Salem here. We are currently an open shop training agent here in Oregon. It hasn't always been that way. As a matter of record, it was a hard-fought process that took a significant amount of time, with many obstacles, a lot of money, and a big commitment to apprenticeship. We were able to persevere and start the Oregon Columbia Tile Trades JATC. It's an open shop training program. Second one in the country, first one on the West Coast. Since then, I have served as chair for the Government Affairs Committee for Associated Builders and Contractors, the Pacific Northwest Chapter. I also serve on the board of Northwest College of Construction here in Portland, and Northwest College of Construction hosts seven different apprenticeship training programs. My point in all that is I'm invested and dedicated to the training and apprenticeship, and I appreciate all that we can do to promote and encourage apprenticeship in a thoughtful manner. House Bill 3115, there under this House Bill 3115, there is a good chance that our firm would not have been able or allowed to work on public projects the entire time we were working through this process, even though we were committed to training, which I think is well demonstrated today. One thing that we learned in this process of getting involved is that it is very difficult to change something that after the fact that's happened, something after the fact. But if we can be involved in the process on the front end, you can be part of the solution, which is the result of my being here today. After looking at this bill, and I will state that I had not seen the dashes, so I'm just going to address it as I wrote it. I see a few sections here that had concern for me. It was in Section 2, Line 10. What this does is immediately limit the playing field from all eligible to a limited few. Section 2, lines 14 and 15, this was our case. We bid a job. We were the low bidder, but because we were not a training agent at the time, we were either required to apply to a union program as a non-union training agent, creating a very volatile environment, or give up the right to do the work, which was the case in our situation. We gave up the right to do the work, and it cost the taxpayer about 35% more. Because the next lowest bid was that much higher. Section 4, on paper, this seems reasonable, but changing job site conditions can drastically impact this, such as scheduling. If you bid a job and it starts out a certain way and you're trying to meet your requirements, a lot of times on the back end of a job, which is where we end up, we're required to man up to keep the schedule. And the only way that we can do that is by either how it impacts apprenticeship is it impacted by the ratios, because if we have to man up, then we have to make sure we're meeting those ratios a certain level, and that can cost either us or the taxpayer significant more money. So keep in mind that these are situations where as a contractor may not feel it's appropriate to use, there's also situations where contractors don't feel it's appropriate to use apprentices on a job. My peers and other crafts make a reasonable case that there are hazardous situations that sometimes do not make sense for apprentices. They can require very skilled and very specific craftspeople where apprentices just are not ready. While this bill is project-specific rather than contractor-specific on the 10% hour requirements, we need to be very careful on that front. Contractors need the flexibility to make your taxpayer-funded projects come in safely and on time. On Section 8, it talks about the task force that Boley was required to do. I actually sat on that task force, and in that process, I came to realize that no matter how much planning you do and what great intentions you have, it's extremely difficult to bring in anyone, let alone minorities, into apprenticeship, even under the best of times. We've had that experience. So to impose fines for not meeting these quotas is actually counterproductive. Again, I didn't see the dashes, and so they're addressing that. However, verbiage of 3% retainage and then holding, you know, then inflicting, if I understood Representative Holy correctly, you're withholding the 3%, but if you didn't make it, you're still paying a fine. That's kind of a question.
I think so, but
I wasn't sure.
And by the way, colleagues, the great thing about, you know, talking a lot about a subject is you talk long enough and more amendments show up, and the dash twos have been completed. They're being printed right now. So thank you.
So all of this verbiage, quite honestly, concerns me. Imposing work, certifying from our surety, increasing costs, unintended issues that would need to be addressed. So a couple other things, a lot of verbiage that was deemed necessary or reasonable time. Those are types of words that concern me on a bill like this, as well as the commissioner chooses. Those types of things would be better said more specific. So maybe apparently that's being addressed in dash one and two. So having said that, all, I would also like to say that if needed, I'd be more than willing to work on any other type of process to help move this apprenticeship ideas forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knutz. Thanks for coming forward. Thanks for that offer, and thanks for your work with the Northwest College of Construction. Dr. Mollis.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. My name is John Mollis. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Building Trades Council. We believe that this proposal is a step in the right direction. One of the reasons that we're supportive is that it calls out for apprenticeship utilization per subcontract rather than just general contract overall. And what we've seen in the past, when you have a 10% goal for the whole project, too many times we've seen where a couple of crafts don't get any training at all or very little, and then some other subcontractors are brought in at the end of the job, and they are forced to have high ratios to bring the whole project back up to 10%. So it sometimes can have pretty uneven results. We favor a per-craft scenario, which this bill doesn't call for. The Portland Workforce Training and Hiring Program, that is a per-craft system. Now, you're probably not going to take that exact system and move it to Burns or LeGrand, but that's one example where a per-craft does and can work. The per-subcontract, like I said earlier, should result in more even training and more crafts being trained on the project. You've just heard from a couple of the opponents. Chair Dembro, you've referenced that there are more amendments coming, and I would just like to make a similar offer. If there's more amendments or changes in the future, I would be happy to be part of that discussion. The building trades has concerns about the Senate bill that Mr. Rakowicz referred to. I'll save those comments until it gets down here.
Okay.
Like I said, if there's further work to be done this session, I would be pleased to be a part of it. If the chair and others would decide to appoint a task force or a work group to work in the interim and get folks all in the same room to try and come up with something, I'd be pleased to be part of that as well. So thanks for the time to make a few remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mollis. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know exactly how the process works, but I'm assuming, and it could vary per trade, but you have to have a journeyman that's overseeing apprentice training. Is it possible under 3115 increasing the number of apprentices being trained on a job site, the cost of the job might possibly also increase because you would have to have maybe more journeymen there in some cases? Would that affect this at all? Or nobody mentioned that. I'm just kind of curious how that would work.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Huffman, the ratios for journeymen to apprentices are set inside of each craft's Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committee. And I don't think there's anything in this bill that would address it, and I honestly don't believe, and I would let the folks on either side weigh in as well, I don't think there's anything in the bill that would change that, in all honesty.
John Rakowitz, for the record. I believe when you get what my contractors tell me, and we've done a lot of work in this session to try to sort out what one would look like, structure something that makes sense, and again, work for all contractors, open and union, specialty in general, and all types of construction in all parts of the state. We believe that if you get beyond the percentage requirements that we've laid out in Senate Bill 782, you actually will begin in some jobs to do exactly what you suggested, Representative Huffman. You start to have to figure out a way on the front end to ensure that you can meet the numbers. In order to do that, you start to drive up the cost because you're not sure that you can do it. And in particular, you especially when you get outside the I-5 corridor, there are just not always programs available. So one of the fears that we have, and this is a really important point, is that the smaller contractors that operate in the smaller markets in the state of Oregon will simply be disadvantaged because they don't have available to them the kind of apprentices or programs. So we're fearful, and remember, we're a statewide organization. We look at it from every point of view throughout the state, that some of our I-5 corridor contractors will have a distinct advantage. So this is a really complicated issue. The deeper I've gotten into it, I started working on this issue in 2009. In this session, we've done a lot of work on it. We've met with Mr. Mollis, we've met with the carpenters, we've met with Mr. Holvey, we've met with the chair of this committee, we've met with ODOT, we've met with DAS. So we've worked real hard to try to sort our way through this. Apprenticeship programs have existed, like I said in my opening testimony, for over 100 years. They will continue to exist. The question is, does Oregon want to take the step of establishing for the first time an apprenticeship utilization requirement on public works at whatever percentage? Ours are the larger percentage than House Bill 3115. Then it's the complexities of how you make that work. Per overall job, which is what we propose, versus every single contractor, general and sub, has to meet its own particular. Now you're getting into the complexity of trying to make a job work, a piece of a job work, when you're faced with the kind of ratios that Mr. Mollis just referenced. There are 35, 40, I believe, apprenticeable occupations this would apply to. Each one of them have their own apprenticeship ratio to journeyman. Some it's, 1 to 3, 1.5 to 3. You can imagine how complicated that starts to get when you impose, in particular, every single subcontractor will have its own beginning 10% minimum, and in 2017, 15% minimum. It starts to get complicated, and I believe will drive up costs.
Thank you, Mr. Rakowitz. Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, you made another point of mine that I think it would exacerbate a problem that we have on the east side and in rural Oregon in general. Last year I had a conversation with General Caldwell from the National Guard. We're building a new readiness center in the Dalles. Mm-hmm. And there was a lack of local subcontractor invitation. And I, so we have that problem anyway in rural Oregon, and I see this as just exacerbating that problem. I guess I don't need a comment on that.
Rep. Gilman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And real quickly, we don't want to deal in too many acronyms for the freshmen on the panel. ODOT is the Oregon Department of Transportation.
Is that like DMV?
Well, I don't know what that would stand for.
Thanks, Rep. Gilliam.
My pleasure.
I appreciate
it. And of course, as usual, my ignorance on this issue and other issues will become apparent. I bow to your experience. I did a little project in shop when I was in high school that remained in a vise for two semesters after I was in the class. And then when I got it back, it had the number on the wood on the upside of it. So I have very little experience. I want to go back to a premise that was mentioned when this bill was first sort of introduced to us a few minutes ago, where I think the speaker said, it was previous to you three, often, all of a sudden, we have to, you know, get rid of our apprentices. And I just want to make sure I understand the premise. All of a sudden, is it you're feeling that it's capricious, that it's anti-apprentice, that it's somehow it's a, you know, a preconceived idea against apprentice, or is there other, are there other economic factors that lead to this? Because I'm all for working this out, and I'm interested in all the amendments, but I had a little concern about that premise. It doesn't have to be John. It can be anybody.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Gilliam, what I've seen over the past 4 years as the work initially just went off a cliff and then has very, very, very slowly recovered, and Mr. Rakowitz represents the contractors, and Mr. Coots is a contractor, but what I've seen is as contractors had a certain number of people on the payroll, journeymen and apprentices, and then all of a sudden had work for this many, they had to make the very, very difficult decision on which ones to keep busy. And that's a very tough call, and it's just resulted in a huge plug in the pipeline because 90% of an apprentice's learning is on-the-job training. And then if you're not starting new apprentices, then you don't start. It's tougher on the pre-apprenticeship providers to keep training those people to get into our apprenticeship programs. So without trying to speak for Representative Holvey, that's just been my opposition or my observation.
Thank you. That's a very helpful background to that subject.
Rep. Wisland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, today is tax day. I would appreciate John, if you could give this committee your estimate of what complying with Representative Hovey's proposal would cost the Oregon taxpayers on this April 15th day, because what I'm hearing from Mr. Coots is that, there's 30% more to start with, and trying to comply with this makes it much more. We're spending taxpayers' money here, so I would appreciate the committee having some sort of estimate that wouldn't come from LFO, because we're talking about the customer, the taxpayer. Thank you.
I'll take a shot at it. Chair Dembrough, Representative Wisnett. I don't think anybody can predict what it will cost, because I believe it will be job by job. And as I said, the most important thing for us is that it be flexible, and that it be, if there's going to be an apprenticeship utilization requirement, and that it be at a number that does not drive up cost. That's how we anchored our number at 10% and 12% down the road. It allows time for agencies to figure out how to do this, and for contractors all around the state to figure out how they're going to comply. I cannot give you a figure, and I doubt that there's anybody who can, because it will apply differently in each kind of job. But I will say that we have had repeated conversations that if you get too high, And we've seen this on recent jobs. When you start moving above 12%, certainly, now you're talking about the real risk. And that's all I can speak to is the risk that there will be real increased cost on some of these jobs. Not to mention, agencies trying to figure out how to do this. And as far as the craft specific, I do have to go back to something Mr. Mullis spoke about. I don't want to speak on behalf of ODOT, but I did sit around a table that was as big as a UN table to try to sort that program out for a year and a half. It was a complicated, tough job, and we got there. At the very beginning, there was discussion about craft-specific. It didn't work. And I would urge any member of the committee to talk to ODOT about any of this, because they're the only state agency that really has the experience over many years of making this work in a way that contractors can make it work. Again, only one type of construction, one type of public owner, a program, not a statewide utilization apprenticeship standard that applies broadly. Really different approach to it.
Thank you, Mr. Rakowitz. And okay, just very, very quickly, please, Rep. Johnson. We'll have to come back to this on Wednesday. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to our panel for being here in front of this Higher Ed and Business and Labor Committee today. It's good to have you all here. Mr. Rakowitz, talking about retainage, the dash twos, which I have in my hot little hands here, say a state contracting agency shall retain an amount equivalent to not more than 3% of the amount due a contractor under a contract for an entire public improvement or as appropriate under each contract or subcontract for the public improvement. That, you mentioned it earlier, that could be problematic. Would you rather see, would it be more efficient in your mind for the general to be the administrator of this or the overseer of this, or in your Senate Bill 782, how do you structure that? Who is in charge of ensuring that whatever the standard is, whether it's 10 or 15%, that it's met and so forth? But to me, it seems like it's a cost driver either way.
Chair Dimbrough, Representative Johnson, in Senate Bill 782, it's really simple. An agency will expect the general contractor to produce the 10% of apprenticeship. How and when and with what parts of the job will be determined by the general contractor. On the subject of retainage, I'm going to try to contain my emotions. For the last 3 or 4 years, we have had within our industry enormous struggles and divisions about the issue of retainage. It is an issue of cash flow. I don't care what size of contractor you are, but specifically the smaller and specifically the specialty contractors really have struggled in tight times where cost, any owner, public or private, are driving down cost. So the bill that passed, I think, 3 weeks ago, 26-4 on the Senate side, eliminates any ability for any kind of exception and creates a flat 5% allowable retainage up and down the chain. Meaning, public owner, you can retain 5%. General, you can't retain any more than that. First tier sub, you can't retain any more than that. The purpose there is to keep the money flowing, particularly in the times we face. So if you throw in a highly specialized 3% for one aspect of the job, apprenticeship utilization, I have no idea how that would work, to be blunt about it. So I consider it a real difficulty. How Senate Bill 782 does it is very simple. It's a $20 per hour reimbursement rate established. You get paid for what you do, and don't get paid for what you don't do. That simple.
So it's an incentive program, essentially.
It's a disincentive. You either do it or you don't, and you get paid for what you don't. And remember, this with ODOT, for example, the agency has to estimate the number of hours to get to what is a 10%, what is a 12%. We have to estimate those hours up front. In a unit pricing kind of environment that ODOT operates in, it's a little easier to do that. On a just lump sum payment on the building side, We have no idea how that would occur. And that's why you see our approach as being very slow and methodical to try to sort out what's happening, in addition to any of the other issues that Mr. Kutz has raised. So,
okay. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. We're going to have to move on. I think Mr. Rakowitz framed it very well in that, you know, we have to decide, does the state feel that incentivizing apprenticeship, if I can put it that way, is in the public interest? And then, if so, how do we do it the right way? And I think, just speaking for myself, I do believe that the on-the-job training kind of education that is part of apprenticeship is just as vital to this state as all the community colleges and all the universities that we fund. And so we need to figure out how to do this. We need to figure out how to do it right. Whether or not the dash twos of this bill are the right way, I urge you to look it over. And if you have any questions, pose it to them, to Representative Holby or, you know, any of the other parties, and we'll dispose of this on Wednesday. Yes, Rep. Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the last session, I worked in general government. And there's no way that as a committee we can objectively look at this without hearing from ODOT, from hearing from Treasurer, from hearing from DAS. They're the ones this bill is requiring to do something.
Thank you, Rep. Wisnant. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3115, and now we'll move on to some of the other issues on our agenda. I'm going to open a work session. Colleagues, the can we do 2152?
Yeah.
Okay. So, as not surprisingly, we're not going to be dealing with House Bills 2149 or 3120 today, the governance issues. So those of you who are here specifically for those we are in the process of soliciting final amendments for House Bill 3120. We will be in a position to vote on that on Wednesday. But I will open a work session on House Bill 2152. And Victoria, please remind me and all of us of what this bill is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2152 requires the State Board of Higher Education and Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to conduct annual reviews of public universities and community colleges, respectively, regarding staffing to student ratios, declares an emergency, is effective on passage. You have the Dash 1 amendments before you. They specify the data to be used from the U.S. Department of Education. The new Section 3 requires reporting FTE in the following categories for universities: supervisory employees, full-time faculty, part-time faculty, and classified employees, and for OUS, supervisory and non-supervisory employees. Specifies the first report is due by October 1st, 2013. It does have a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means.
Thank you, Victoria. So, you know, first of all, let me say that we had a work group that was convened to work on the details of this. I want to thank Alethea Miller for staffing that work group. It involved a number of people from the community college world, from the university world, to try to get it right. It became clear that we have challenges in the area of apples to apples, and even to some extent, and this surprised me, the degree to which the institutions have difficulty knowing just who is working for them. Hopefully this is something that will change in the future in improved data systems, but for now we do have some challenges. And dealing with those challenges, the work group made recommendations that are reflected in the Dash 1 amendments to 2152. Basically, they're calling on the community colleges and the universities to use, to report to the legislature using the standard metrics that are already being sent to the federal government. You may remember that those are not perfect. Everyone recognizes that they are they're a relatively blunt instrument, but they are standard, and so it is a way. Remember, one of the issues here is we want to get a sense of just what is happening with the amount of the budget that's going into administrative costs to deal with that challenge that, you know, many people see too much money going into administration in the institutions. So it does give us some standard language, even though it's not perhaps the best metrics at this point. On the university side, there is a sense that perhaps they, along with that information, they can go one step better. And so you'll see in Section 3 of the amendments that they're going to produce information giving us the employees and also the number of supervisors of those employees. So we'll be able to track that as well. And it also will look at supervisor versus non-supervisor within the central chancellor's office of the university system as well, or whatever it is that comes to take its place. So those are the Dash 1 amendments. We are in a work session, and
Chair Dembro, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, which are dated April 11th, 2013.
Vice Chair Harker moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated April 11th, 13. Is there any discussion of these amendments, colleagues? Is there any objection to our adopting these amendments? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Sure. Chair Dembro, I move House Bill 2152 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Harker moves House Bill 2152 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion, Rep. Wisman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think early in the session you talked to me a little bit about this bill, and you and I worked on other bills together that looked at this, but the more I've learned about what's happening in the education system, I think it's premature to do this till we see what's happening in shared services and things like that. I think it would be better to wait and reintroduce this bill as the organization makes itself known. I would then probably be supportive of that, but I just think doing it now with everything's possibly being discussed as far as the shared services and who's going to be under who and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. It may not be the right time, Mr. Chair, for my PIP vote. Thank you.
I hear your point, Rep. Wisman. I'll just respond. First of all, the first report under this, the amendments, will be October 1st of this year. What that will do is it'll give us a baseline, you know, for moving forward. And it is important to have baselines. And then we can get a sense of, you know, what changes happen as the new structures are put in place. So that would be my recommendation to move forward. Vice Chair Huffman.
Mr. Chair, was none of this covered in the recent audits done by the Secretary of State's Office on Community Colleges and Higher Ed?
I don't believe so. I think when we get into that audit in detail, you'll detect a certain level of frustration with the auditors because there is not consistent reporting, I think we'll get into that issue. And I have to say, I share the frustration of the auditors in this matter. It's amazing to me, frankly, that we don't have this information, that this isn't something that the institutions have ready access to. They give checks to their employees at least once a month. They should know who works for them. They should know the job that this person does. This is a work in progress, obviously. Yes, Rep. Gillian.
I hope this isn't a too oversimplified question, but have we, and by that I mean this committee as chair, et cetera. Have we asked for this information over time?
We have. In 2009, we passed the bill 2557, which did ask for information with respect to faculty and full-time faculty and part-time faculty. And that too was initially at least a challenge for the institutions because it meant that they had to identify, you know, who exactly was working for them in what capacity. But we have, I think, made progress in that. My sense is that we will make progress once we have this this demand made of them. Yes, Rep. Johnson.
And Mr. Chair, I guess to take a step further, once we have that information, what will be the next step?
That's a good question. You know, and we'll, information is good. Putting a spotlight on issues is good, and then we'll see what it leads to. It may well be, colleagues, that, you know, as I think I suggested to you earlier on, that this notion of administrative bloat is an urban legend. You know, it may be an urban myth. It may not really be there. But if we don't track this information, how are we going to know? So, yes,
just quickly, out of courtesy for your leadership, I will vote for this, but I have to say it hurts when you don't, when you say to him, it was a good question. You never say that to me.
I was asking a good question.
No.
No.
Oh, I didn't know you were still in here.
Yes. No, it's a fair point, Rep. Gilliam. And I will try to keep my mind open to all that you propose. Okay. Seeing no further discussion, Cassie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Gaines?
Yes.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Greenland?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Respectfully, no.
Representative Woodman?
Yes.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoffman?
I don't think so.
Chair Duffy?
Yes. Okay, the motion passes. It goes to Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2152. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2995. Victoria?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2995 requires each public university, community college, or other institution of higher education to allow students, faculty, and staff to identify sexual orientation on forms used to collect demographic data, minimal expenditure impact, no revenue impact.
Okay. Can somebody give me a motion on this? Thanks.
Chair Dambro, I move House Bill 2995 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Harker moves House Bill 2995 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Rep. Greenland.
I raised some confidentiality issues when the bill was being heard and had a chance to meet with the folks, the proponents, and I feel comfortable that there are safeguards in place.
Thank you, Rep. Greenland. Further discussion? Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I talked to Maura, and I'm going to give this a soft yes. I don't think it's going to do anything close to what was being testified about. Just wanted to get that on the record, but I will be a yes.
Thank you, Rep. Huffman. Rep. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was a long time ago, I think, we had the public hearing. Does OSA...
It was a week ago. It feels like a month.
It's a long time. I repeat my studies.
Maybe I raised those questions on a different bill.
Mr. Chair, did we get testimony and support from OSA, OUS, and community colleges?
You know, actually, colleagues, I'm at a disadvantage because I was next door testifying during this. But I did listen to the record, and I believe that OSA spoke in favor of it.
Definitely.
Someone from OSU, someone from Portland State.
Mike Hood.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah. They want it, they got it. Any further discussion of this bill? Seeing none, Cassie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Hagler.
Aye.
Representative Gillian.
No.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative Greenland.
Yes.
Representative
Johnson.
Yes.
Representative
Woodson.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hoffman.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yes.
So that's what you call it.
The motion passes. Rep. Gelser will carry. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2995. And I will open a work session on House Bill 3079. Okay. Colleagues, House Bill 3079 has amendments before you. Well, actually, why don't we start off, Victoria, could you remind
us? We're still waiting on amendments for 3079.
We haven't gotten them yet. Huh? Yeah. Okay, well, I'll just explain what's going on there.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3079 requires for-profit institutions of higher education to provide students with fact sheets regarding costs of education, loans, job placement rates, and related data prior to enrollment. Specifies standards for data and rates provided. Requires annual report to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Prohibits institutions with specified loan default rates from operating in Oregon. Regulates advertising and solicitation of students by for-profit institutions of higher education. Authorizes Attorney General to impose civil penalty not to exceed $5,000 for each violation of the act, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Okay, thank you, Victoria. So this is another another bill that is being amended thanks to the good support work, again, of Alethea Miller, who convened the work group, and Rep. Johnson and I participated in it. This was a very substantial work group, very large in number, included people from the colleges, the universities, the for-profit sector, the independent college sector, looking at House Bill 3079, and you'll remember that our goal there was also to incorporate the goals of two other bills, one sponsored by Rep. Johnson and one by me, and to put them all together into a bill that would provide transparency and, to the greatest extent possible, consistency in the way that information is being made available to students as they're seeking to enroll in an institution of higher education. And the original bill, 3079, also included some penalties that would be handled through the AG's office for violations. That section has been dropped in the amendments, and it also included it suggested that there was a level out there of default rate, and if any schools exceeded that default rate, they could not, the HEC could impose on them the penalty of not being able to operate here in Oregon. That section has been dropped as well. We decided collectively that the best thing to do at this point would be to track things like default rates and transferability and access to licensure and all those other issues that we heard concerns about, and many of which expressed by members of this committee. So that's what you'll see in the amendments that are coming your way. But I thought they'd be here already, they're not. So I'm going to end up carrying over this work session till Wednesday. My hope is that we'll be able to close this off. Rep. Johnson, do you have anything you want to add about it?
No, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we've had, a fairly inclusive process, and I too look forward to seeing the amendments that I think can make this good for the whole and not just single out the for-profits.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Hoffman.
Rep. Johnson, clarification on that. Is the amendment going to include all institutions, public, and that's where it's headed? Okay, thank you.
Yes. And just to clarify, you know, our goal is that students will be able to, when they're trying to decide what school they're going to go to, they will be able to go to a central website operated by the Office of Degree Authorization, you know, which as of July of this year will comprise both the degree-granting colleges and universities and the career colleges under the direction of the HEC. They'll have a website. A student can go to it and, you know, can see all the information provided by all the schools that are, you know, operating here. And again, being done in to the greatest extent possible in an apples-to-apples manner. The school will be required to send students to that website and also to provide the student with the same information that is on the website. Again, you know, just so it's very clear what they're getting into. Okay. Any other questions about it at this point? Okay. Again, these amendments should be coming momentarily, and so we'll send them to you as soon as we get them. Look for them in your email. So with that, I will close this work session on House Bill 3079. And later on, I'll carry it over with all the others. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3149. House Bill 3149, this is the Task Force on Community College Child Care Services. And do we have an amendment for this, Victoria?
Yes, we do. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have -3 amendments which change the appointment and composition of the task force to one senator and one representative as non-voting members. The community college's commissioner to appoint the remaining members, at least 2 faculty and 2 students, and that there is to be consultation with stakeholder groups, and that is required in the -3 amendments.
Okay. Anybody? Do we have a motion?
Chair Demereaux, I move that we adopt the -3 amendments dated March 26, 2013.
Vice Chair Harker moves to adopt the -3 amendments dated March 26, 2013. Any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the -3s are adopted.
Chair Demereaux, I move House Bill 3149 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Harker moves House Bill 3149 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the members of this committee that have sponsored this bill, and I think it's definitely a need. I know that. I think community colleges need that. I can't support the bill. I think that the community colleges themselves, the students in those communities, should do it. It should be a local initiative, not a statewide initiative. Every situation, you know, I have 15 years of my life involved in the Commission on Children and Families, and what the problem in Portland area and the I-5 corridor is different for child care than it is in Central Oregon, and those need to be addressed by the local universities, and I apologize, or I don't respect my members, but I'll be a no.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Seeing none, Cassie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Gillian?
No.
Representative Gorsuch?
Yes.
Representative Greenwood?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Wisnant?
No.
Vice Chair Harker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Huffman?
No.
Chair Dunbro?
Aye. The motion passes. This bill will go down to Ways and Means. Thank you. I'll close the work session on House Bill 3149. And I will open a work session on House Bill 3341. Colleagues, House Bill 3341 is the bill that deals with the issue of adverse impact for new programs. You have a set of amendments, -1s, are they? -2s. Right. The dash twos are we're amending in language that was proposed by the Northwest Career College Federation that calls on the HEC to explore areas of improved partnership between the different sectors, the public sector and the for-profit sector, to avoid unnecessary duplication and to seek areas of partnership, better collaboration, looking at best practices from other states, also looking at the impact of online education. There is concern that about online programs from schools that are based outside of the state that are beaming their curriculum into the state that was expressed, and that the HEC will report on its findings to the next legislature, which, colleagues, you know, I think as we discussed on Friday, is one of the things that the HEC is really set up to do, is to look at issues like this and to advise the legislature. So that's what these dash two amendments do. And
we don't have the fiscal on the dash twos. Because
okay, we're not going to have, we don't have fiscals, but I'd like to get these adopted if possible.
Well, to help you do that, Chair Dembro, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated April 12, 2013.
Vice Chair Harker moves to adopt the dash two amendments dated March 12, 2013. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Okay. The dash twos are amended. Colleagues, we don't, as I said, we don't have a fiscal for it, so we can't move the bill. But at this time, does anybody have any questions or any comments about it? Okay. Seeing none, then I will close the work session on this bill, House Bill 3341. And I will open a work session on House Bill 3472. House Bill 3472 is, we have some amendments for this. You'll remember that we, that you all requested that two bills become one. And we had the bill that was the Pay It Forward bill, and we had the bill that was the Western Promise tuition freeze bill, both of which we're going to go to the HEC to look at, perhaps do pilots with, and so it was your pleasure to bring them together, and your wish is Victoria's command, so that has been done.
Oh, wow. Excellent. Chair Dembro, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated April 10th, 2013.
Vice Chair Harker moves to adopt the dash one amendments dated March
10th,
2013.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for working with us, the sponsors of 3472, to combine these. I'd like to carry this over and talk to you. I'm concerned about the amendment that might put a financial impact that could kill this. Because I read the amendment to say, your amendment to say, they will create a joint program to do the pay forward, pay back. I'd like to, you know, have you consider depending up on the financial situation to do that. Because I don't know, I'm just afraid if we task it, I don't know how we can. Again, if they pick a big, if you're going to pick a big university, a small university, how they could do that? Am I wrong? Am I not seeing this right?
I believe that
it'll create a proposed pilot program.
Yeah, that the pilot program is going to have to come to us for approval.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
You said very much.
yet submitted to us for approval. Page 3, line 7.
A proposed pilot, so it's not doing a pilot.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Any further discussion, colleagues? Okay, seeing none.
That was just the motion on the amendments.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay, then, is there any objection to the amendments? Okay. Vice Chair Harker.
Chair Dembro, I move House Bill 3472 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill would be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Harker moves to adopt the dash one amendments. I'm sorry. Yes.
You are.
We're here, right?
Mm-hmm.
We already adopted the dash one. So.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Vice Chair Harker moves House Bill 3472 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussions of the new bill? Seeing none, is there any objection to this bill? Okay. Seeing none, the bill motion passes. It will go to Ways and Means. Colleagues, the Pay It Forward bill was a committee bill, whereas the new newly synthesized bill 3472 is a member bill, chief sponsored by Reps Harker and Wisnant. It is now available for you all to sign. And Gilliam?
Whoa, I'm impressed.
Don't leave him out again. You slate him again.
And Gilliam.
Can I just go down there and sit? Is that what you want? Don't answer.
Are you a chief sponsor, Rep. Gilliam?
Yeah,
really?
I've lost track.
Wow.
Red letter day.
I am impressed. Anyway, the rest of you, aside from that esteemed troika, can now sign on.
I have a point of order, Mr. Chair.
Please, proceed.
I'm confused, and it's because of Representative Huffman. When we vote, are we not to vote aye or nay? There's all these other, maybe kind of soft. Do we have a range of votes or
qualifier vote? Absolutely.
Rep. Gilliam, this is the Committee on Higher Education, and, we appreciate nuance and subtlety. The world is not black and white. There are shades of gray.
And when you say we,
I believe we live in a dichotomous world.
Mr. Chair, we had a work group analyzing this exact question, I'm sure, a couple of sessions back, and Representative Gilliam just missed that one.
They got stuck in
the room. Oh, so we never can.
Okay, I think I have not yet closed this work session. And I'm going to. Close the work session on House Bill 3472. Colleagues, we have some bills still to carry over, and so I'm going to carry over House Bill 3115, House Bill 2149, House Bill 3120, House Bill 3079, House Bill 3341, and House Bill 2986. We will reconvene Wednesday morning, 8 o'clock, and with the stars being aligned, we will dispose of all of our business. Rep. Greenlick, you look quizzical. Okay. With that, colleagues, we are adjourned.